lives have been transformed. They can help you understand what this journey is all about. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome to Tom and Felicia. The audience applauded. Andy applauded, then froze. Felicia was the woman who had been kicked out of the thrift store. They looked like two very normal people. He wore jeans and a flannel shirt. She wore slacks and a sweater. They weren't great public speakers, but they talked intelligently, honestly. The man spoke first, then Felicia. She was particularly interesting. Earlier, Andy had been right on the money when she'd guessed the woman was out of place in a thrift store. It was no surprise she walked with polish. Felicia was a college graduate. She had run her own travel agency for 9 years. She had been married to an architect who lived in Seattle. She hadn't been unhappy, just disconnected. She gave it all up for one simple reason. Steve Bleckman changed my life. No, no, said Bleckman. You changed your life. Right, she said, as if he were always right. I did it. Bleckman thanked his friends and opened the floor to questions from the audience, which took another 20 minutes. Most people asked legitimate questions. A few were cynics who just wanted to rattle him. Friend or foe, Bleckman treated each of them with respect. His message never wavered. He never lost his cool. It was impressive. The man could talk. Felicia explained his gift. He's better connected to the source than you or I. Bleckman smiled modestly and laughed it off. He checked his watch. Their hour was up. He returned to the podium. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope this has been more than just a form of entertainment for you. For me, Tom, Felicia, and many, many others, it is a lifelong cause. As we've stated all along, we do not recruit members. We leave it up to each of you to decide for yourself whether you want to take that big first step. If anyone is interested, we're having a retreat this weekend. We leave Friday night and return Sunday. It's not a pleasure trip. There are some cabins in the mountains. It's cold, but there are wood-burning stoves and plenty of blankets. There's no fast food, only what nature provides. It's about getting back to the source. The purpose isn't for you to learn more about us. It's a chance to learn more about yourself. We'd love to see you there. Thank you all for coming. Bleckman left the room to a warm but not overwhelming ovation. A few people didn't applaud at all. They headed straight for the exits, shaking their heads. Others were more intrigued. They milled about the exit, taking more pamphlets and asking questions of the girl at the door. She had a sign-up list for people who wanted to receive additional information in the mail. Several people signed. She also had videotapes for sale, for those who wanted to relive the studio version of tonight's experience or share it with their friends. Andy bought one, then followed the dozen or so others who drifted toward the front of the room. Tom and Felicia were answering questions. Tom had a clipboard with a sign-up list for the retreat. Andy made her way toward Felicia, who was talking to a college-age man, telling him what to pack for the weekend and what to expect. Andy waited behind him. When they finished, Andy moved up. Felicia immediately recognized her. Hello. You work at Second Chance, don't you? Andy smiled shyly. Yeah. Sorry about what happened. That's okay. Mrs. Rankin doesn't think much of our group. I'm afraid Mrs. Rankin doesn't think much of anyone. They shared a laugh. Felicia asked, What's your name? Kira. Well, Kira, are you going to join us this weekend? She wanted to appear indecisive, unsure of herself, the kind of person they'd prey upon. I don't know, she said with a shrug. Come on, I think you'd be perfect. You really think so? I know so. Andy blinked demurely. Will Steve be there? Felicia smirked, another smitten young woman. Of course. Well, what the heck? What have I got to lose? Atta girl. Just check in with Tom. He's got the sign-up list and all the info. Thanks. You're welcome. I'll see you Friday. Andy drifted toward Tom. He was talking to the old couple Bleckman had teased during his presentation. The wife was lukewarm, but the husband was excited and ready to sign up. Andy, too, was excited, though she tried not to show it. She had a sixth sense about Bleckman and his teachings. Beth Wheatley's disappearance was taking on a whole new face. She couldn't wait for Friday. Just remember, your name is Kira. Chapter 45. Gus met his investigator for an early Wednesday breakfast. Dex picked Café René again, his favorite. It was starting to grow on Gus, too. There was something endearing about a place so unpretentious that it printed its dubious review from Seattle Weekly right on the menu. The food and service are equally bad, but at least the atmosphere's lousy. Dex gorged himself on a thick slice of Canadian bacon and a mountain of scrambled eggs smothered in ketchup. Gus nibbled on a side order of toast as they hashed out Shirley Borge. "First thing," said Dex with his mouth full, "you gotta decide just how important Shirley really is." "There's only one way to read that polygraph. She may not know for certain where Beth is, but she either knows some people or knows something about Beth that gives her a pretty good idea what happened to her."
"Maybe she'll cool off in a day or so and talk to you."
"I don't think so." Dex added even more ketchup.
"You could play hardball. Get the FBI to put some pressure on until she comes back and talks to you. Solitary confinement. Move her to a cell with a backed-up toilet. One thing about life in prison, it can always get worse."
"Those kinds of games might just push her further away."
"Well, maybe she'll just cough up what she knows."
"Or she'll be even more ticked off and Beth will get killed." Dex gulped down half his glass of orange juice. His eyes bulged as his stomach erupted in scrambled egg revolt, but he managed to keep it silent.
"You got two choices. You either got to go through Shirley Borge or around her."
It sounded like mindless jock talk. What is that supposed to mean?
"Shirley has information you want. You tell him you can't beg it, force it, or buy it out of her. So go around her. Find someone else. Someone who knows her secrets."
"Like who?"
Dex shrugged. "The usual suspects? Friends? Lovers?"
"That's a list I don't have."
"Don't need the whole list. Just one person she might have confided in somewhere along the line."
Gus sipped his coffee, thinking. Then his eyes brightened. Dex smiled thinly.
"You got one already?"
Gus lowered his cup, then answered, "I think maybe I do." Sympathy got Gus an immediate meeting with Kirby Toombs. Rarely did he make himself available on a moment's notice, but he made an exception for a fellow member of the bar whose wife was missing. Kirby had read about Gus's plight in the newspapers. Though he had seen the reward advertised, he was completely unaware that Shirley Borge had responded to it. After Gus explained his predicament on the phone, Kirby couldn't blame him for wanting to talk to the lawyer who had represented her. Kirby had been a rookie public defender at the time of Shirley's trial. Many talented lawyers had come out of the PD's office, but Kirby wasn't one of them. He had been fired 4 months ago, couldn't find a job, and was now in the process of setting up a solo criminal defense practice. From the looks of things, he had a long way to go. His office was near the state courthouse in a decaying brick building that looked ready for the wrecking ball. Gus knew it well, since one of his clients owned it and was waiting on a historic designation that would make renovation worthwhile. About half the building was vacant. The rest was filled with questionable tenants, many of whom weren't even paying rent. The sign outside Kirby's door read Ventura Enterprises, the name of a former tenant, probably not even the most recent former tenant. Gus rang the buzzer outside the door. It didn't buzz. He tapped on the glass. Kirby answered from behind the closed door.
"Who is it?"
He sounded as though he were talking into a trash can.
"It's Gus Wheatley. I just got off the phone with you."
The chain rattled. Three deadbolts clicked. The door opened. Kirby was standing in the doorway. He was perhaps 2 years out of law school, still sporting the chubby look of a kid who drank too much beer in college. He wore a bad brown suit, the exact shade Gus told the young lawyers in his firm never to wear, unless he wanted to look like a walking turd.
"Come on in."
Gus thanked him and entered. The dowdy suite bore no resemblance to a law office. It was two rooms, counting the tiny reception area. There was no receptionist, just an ugly metal desk and an answering machine. "Want some coffee?" The pot on the credenza looked as if it had been there since Mr. Coffee was in diapers.
"No, thanks."
Kirby poured himself a cup and led Gus to the main office. Dusty Venetian blinds cut the morning sun into slats on the rug. Overloaded banker's boxes were stacked on the desk and couch. Kirby made room for Gus on the couch and took a seat in the squeaky desk chair.
"Just moving in?"
"No,"
he said, a little offended.
"I'm sorry, I just thought..."
I know.
"It doesn't look like the cherry-paneled offices of Preston and Coolidge."
"That's not what I was going to say."
"You didn't have to. It was written all over your face."
"Really, it's not like that at all. I have a lot of respect for a young guy who tries to strike out on his own."
"Yeah, sure you do. I think you mentioned that somewhere in the rejection letter I got from you in law school. Dear Mr. Toombs, thank you very much for your interest in our firm. It gives us all great racking belly laughs to dump on the drones who aren't top 10% in law review."
Gus turned cautious. The guy was a little off.
"It's a competitive market, Kirby. You can't take rejection personally." "How else am I supposed to take it?"
"It's business."
"Easy for you to say, hotshot. Do you have any idea what it feels like to be fired?"
Gus felt a twinge inside. He thought of the way the executive committee had so abruptly removed him as managing partner and replaced him with Martha Goldstein.
"I can imagine." "No, you can't. It hurts, man. And I'm not just talking about your ego. The word gets out on the street. You're damaged goods. I wasn't a bad lawyer. I just didn't get along with the more important people over at the PD's office. So they fired me. Now look at me. There's not a law firm in the city who wants a reject from the public defender's office."
"That doesn't mean you can't land on your feet." He leaned forward, anger in his eyes.
"Look around, asshole. I'm practicing law out of the trunk of my car."
"Who knows? I may be joining you someday."
"Go right ahead. Make jokes."
He wasn't joking, but there was no point in explaining. He changed his tone.
"Is this why you wanted to meet me in person? You want to chew my ass up because you can't find a job? Well, let me tell you something. 2 weeks ago, I would have been the last guy to say this, but there are worse things in life than losing a stupid job. So if we don't start talking about Shirley Borge in the next 30 seconds, I'm walking right out that door. I don't have time for this."
Toombs leaned back smugly, as if it pleased him to irk a man of Gus's stature.
"You want to talk about Shirley Borge? No problem. I'll tell you anything you want to know."
"Thank you.
All I need is a check."
"A check?"
"Yeah. My time is money."
"You want me to pay you for information about Shirley Borge?" He shook his head, grimacing.
"That has such an unseemly connotation, the way you put it. Let's just say I want to be compensated for my time and inconvenience."
Gus didn't have time to lecture the kid on ethics. He laid his checkbook on the desk and started writing.
"Fine. I'll pay you for an hour of your time." "Sounds reasonable. Make it $5,000.
His hand froze. He stopped writing.
"You're joking." "Do I sound like I'm joking? This is robbery. That's probably what your clients say when they see your bills. Payback sucks, doesn't it, Mr. Wheatley?"
Gus hated to give it to him, but he thought of Beth on the other end of the phone, unable to speak, maybe even tied up and gagged. He thought of Shirley slamming the door on him, taking her secrets about Beth back to her cell. This was no time to stand on a $5,000 principle. He wrote the check and signed it. Kirby reached for it. Gus snatched it back.
"First, you answer my questions."
Kirby clearly wanted the check first, but the harsh tone made him back away.
All right. What has Shirley told you so far?
Not much. Most of what I know is from my own research. Newspaper accounts of the trial and such. I know she was convicted of conspiracy to commit murder that was planned but never carried out.
That's the bare bones of it.
Then fill me in.
Supposedly, Shirley and some friends saw some movie on television where homeless people started getting whacked. So they decided that might be a fun way to liven up their weekend.
They were just going to kill a homeless person at random?
That's the story.
How did they get caught?
Well, they didn't just rush out and do it. They started planning. They got hold of a gun. And then Shirley started bragging in bars and places that they had this plan.
So that's who turned them in? Someone from the bar?
No. Actually, it was Shirley's mother.
Gus suddenly recalled the polygraph exam, where Shirley had said she didn't know if her mother was dead or alive.
Why? Shirley had always been a problem kid. So when her mom heard she was getting mixed up in some plan to kill a homeless person, that was the last straw. She decided to put a little scare in her daughter. She went to the police. Turns out the police had more in mind than just scaring her. They put a wiretap on the home phones and recorded Shirley talking about her scheme. The conversations were pretty explicit. Not an easy case to defend. They talked about the time of the hit, the weapon they'd use, how they'd dispose of the gun, what they would do with the body.
So they arrested Shirley before the murder?
Yeah.
Why didn't they arrest her friends?
It was only one friend, actually. At least that's all they had on the tape. No one knew who he was. Both he and Shirley were very careful never to mention his name on the phone. Whenever he called Shirley, he always called from a payphone, so there was no way to trace it.
That's the guy the police wanted Shirley to identify? Asked Gus.
Right. We could have gotten Shirley off pretty easy if she had given up the guy's name, but she wouldn't. So she's living at WCCW.
She did mention how she refused to rat out her friend. She seemed proud of that.
I don't know if it was pride so much as fear that kept her quiet.
Why do you say that?
Good reasons.
Let's hear them.
Let's have the check.
Gus reluctantly laid it on the table. Kirby grabbed it, stuffed it in his coat pocket, and said,
You didn't hear this from me, okay?
Whatever.
Everything I just told you is the story that came out in trial, but that's not the real story.
That's what I'm here for. What's real?
Shirley was mixed up with something weird. This wasn't just some friends who watched television and decided it might be fun to kill a homeless person.
What was it?
I don't know exactly. Some kind of gang, maybe.
Shirley told you this?
Not in so many words. This is mostly my take on it.
Why did they want to kill a homeless person?
His expression turned very serious.
There was never a homeless person.
But what about the recorded phone calls? Surely they must have mentioned the target was a homeless person.
They did, but it was like a code, you know? The homeless lady. Like Monica Lewinsky referring to Bill Clinton as the big creep.
Then who was the real target?
I don't know for sure.
Who do you think it was?
The woman who turned her in.
Her mother?
Kirby nodded.
Her mother.
The wheels were turning. Gangs, serial killings, targeted mothers, missing wives. It wasn't quite as good as Shirley telling him precisely how she knew where Beth was, but it was another promising lead.
This could be very helpful.
Kirby rose.
I aim to please, but if you'll excuse me, I actually have a client to meet at the courthouse in less than 5 minutes.
I won't keep you.
Kirby flashed a cheesy smile.
If there's anything else you need, he said as he tapped the pocket that held the check, I'm sure we can work something out.
He extended his hand. Gus didn't shake it.
I'll see you around, Kirby.
He let himself out and headed down the stairs. As he hurried from the building, the words scumbag came to mind, but he settled on two others, Stop payment. He jumped in his car and sped away. Chapter 46. Andy caught an overnight bus back to Seattle and was back in the office on Wednesday, in time for an impromptu but important team meeting. So important, in fact, that Isaac Underwood cleared his calendar to attend, along with Lundquist, her supervisor, Haveries, her contact agent, and two other members of the Wheatley kidnapping team. At Isaac's request, Victoria Santos participated by speakerphone from Quantico. Based on the advanced briefing Andy had given him by phone, he expected a call on the expertise of a profiler experienced in the ways of New Age cults. They met in a small windowless conference room adjacent to the ASAC's office. Isaac made short work of the preliminaries and turned the meeting over to Andy. She quickly summarized the experiences at Second Chance Clothing Store that had led her to the gathering at Eagle Trace Motel, then spent several more minutes describing the impressive performance of Stephen Blackman. She offered to play the videotape she had purchased, but it was too long for this meeting. The real groaning started when she mentioned the weekend retreat she wanted to attend. It was from Lundquist.
I knew it, he said, shaking his head.
Knew what? Asked Isaac.
This is the problem with using inexperienced agents for cameos. We send her out on a 3-day assignment, and before her 3 days are even up, she's back asking for an extension. Before we know it, we're into a full-blown undercover operation with no way to pay for it.
Isaac said, the most this could ever amount to is a Group 2 operation with a $70,000 maximum. We don't even need headquarters approval for that.
We don't even need anywhere near $70,000, said Andy.
Isaac hedged as if he knew how quickly costs mounted.
Let's put the budget aside for now. I want to know what you plan to accomplish and how you plan to do it. You got the floor, Andy. Sell us.
She silently thanked him, then moved the speakerphone closer so Victoria Santos could hear. None of this makes any sense unless you back up and take a look at a few key facts about Beth Wheatley. First, she has some signs of emotional instability. She falsely accused her husband of spouse abuse. She suffered from bulimia, and she was apparently the most wealthy shoplifter in the history of Nordstrom department stores. Secondly, she physically resembles and shares some other personal characteristics with all three women who have fallen victim to our serial killer. But unlike the others, she may be alive. We've never recovered her body. Her daughter got the Mary Had a Little Lamb phone call, and Beth's fingerprints were found on the payphone in Oregon from which that call was made. Third, Beth had some connection to the Second Chance clothing store in Yakima. One of her dresses was found there. Put that all together, and you're left with an emotionally unstable woman who mysteriously disappeared, who may be alive and held captive by a serial killer, and whose dress is sitting in a thrift shop frequented by members of a New Age cult.
Andy,
the voice came from the speaker box. It was Victoria.
Yes?
Has anyone checked to see if any of the serial killer's victims had friends or family members who disappeared? By disappear, I mean they just ran off and never came back. The way people sometimes do when they join a cult.
Lundquist answered, that's one of the projects our team is undertaking.
Actually, said Andy, I already checked. None of the decedents had friends or family members who were unaccounted for.
Good, said Victoria. Ruling out the obvious is always a good place to start. Now tell me more about the supposed cult itself. I understand the philosophy, but what about its size, its makeup, its physical location?
We have some information on that from the Yakima County Sheriff's Office. They own an old farm just outside Yakima. About 30 people live there. We have photos of some of the members because they were arrested in a peaceable civil disobedience where they chained themselves to the pipes when water and sewer tried to put an irrigation drainage ditch across the land adjacent to their property. According to the arresting officer's report, they seemed like a rather peaceable but paranoid bunch, thinking the whole drainage ditch project was just a government ruse to spy on them.
Any other trouble with the law?
No.
How about the individual members? Any arrest records in the bunch?
Not one of those arrested on the civil disobedience charge had a prior arrest record. They were just ordinary people, much like the people I saw at the meeting last night.
Isaac interjected. So I take it this Shirley Borge over at WCCW has no official connection to the cult?
None that we know of. She wasn't part of the civil disobedience group anyway.
Not to ask a stupid question, Victoria followed up, but I don't suppose Beth Wheatley's picture was among the photos of cult members who were arrested.
No, said Andy, and that's not a stupid question. To address Isaac's question at the outset, one of the things I want to accomplish with this assignment is to determine whether Beth Wheatley is a victim or an accomplice.
Accomplice to what? Asked Lundquist. Let's not lose sight of the fact that this whole theory is based on a tip from a convicted felon who wants to get out of jail, collect $250,000 in reward money, and move to Tahiti. We don't have any evidence that Steve Bleckman or anyone else from this so-called cult has ever met Beth Wheatley, or any other of the victims of this serial killer.
Which is exactly why I need to go on this retreat, said Andy.
Lundquist said, working in a used clothing store in Yakima undercover was one thing. Infiltrating a cult is quite another.
What are you saying? Asked Isaac. That the assignment is foolhardy?
I say that if it's evidence we're after, we get a search warrant and go look for it.
You know as well as anyone that a search warrant has to be specific. We have to list exactly what we're looking for in our affidavit.
How about Beth Wheatley? That's pretty specific. If we really think Beth Wheatley could be at the farm owned by Mr. Bleckman's cult, I say we get a search warrant and turn the place upside down till we find her.
Andy was about to speak, but Victoria beat her to it.
Bad idea, she said loudly over the box. Any overt action by the FBI could prompt the cult members to turn the place into a poison drinking fest, like Heaven's Gate or Jonestown, or a deadly inferno like David Koresh in Waco. Cult members are by definition suicidal, since they've already killed off their past life. From what Andy told us of Bleckman's teachings, this cult is no different. He preaches the need to sever ties with family and friends, everything that keeps you vibrating at a human level. Based on what I've heard, Bleckman isn't afraid to die, and he isn't afraid to take his followers with him, whether they're willing or unwilling.
Lundquist grimaced, seemingly unconvinced.
I'm just trying to strike a reasonable balance here. We have a serial killer who could strike again at any moment. I don't want to get sidetracked on some expensive and protracted undercover operation that turns out to be totally beside the point.
That's a valid concern, said Andy. But storming the compound isn't the answer.
I didn't say storm it, snapped Lundquist. I said get a search warrant. Don't twist my words.
Sorry. But I think the point Victoria was making is that the distinction might be lost on a paranoid group of cult members who went so far as to chain themselves to an irrigation pipe in order to stop the government from spying on them.
Lundquist was searching for a reply, but was coming up empty.
Smartass, he muttered beneath his breath.
Come on, said Isaac. Let's not get personal.
On the contrary, said Lundquist. Now is precisely the time to get personal. I sense you're leaning towards some kind of undercover approach. So the next logical question is, who is the right man for the job?
At the risk of sounding like a bumper sticker, I'd have to say the right man is a woman.
Is that so? Said Lundquist. Andy, why don't you relate to us your previous undercover training and experience?
She had none, but she felt compelled to say something. I did some acting in college.
Wonderful! You can be Eliza Doolittle in the cult revival of My Fair Lady. Isaac, how'd you like to play Henry Higgins?
Enough, said Isaac.
I'm not just taking pot shots, said Lundquist. I like Andy. I think she's got real potential. I just don't want to see her killed on an assignment she's not qualified to handle.
I'm up for it, said Andy.
Think before you talk, kid. You're going inside a cult. Once you're there, you're on your own. Our surveillance agents can't see through walls, and we can't wire you. If they pat you down and find a wire, you're dead. I'm not saying this to be a sexist pig, but with 2 dead men, 3 dead women, and another woman missing, maybe you better think twice before you walk into a cult that may have spawned a serial killer.
She looked at Lundquist and then at Isaac.
I have thought about it. This is what I want to do.
Her gaze fixed on Isaac.
He'd been with her so far, and she expected his approval. She waited. Several seconds passed. She suffered through the silence, begging with her eyes. He said finally, "Let me think about it." "But..." With a quick wave of the hand, Isaac cut her off. Concern was evident in his eyes. Lundquist's speech had gotten to him. "I said I'd think about it." Andy watched with disappointment as he rose from the table and left the room. Chapter 47. Gus had been awake since 3 a.m. That was when Morgan had finally fallen asleep. The nights were getting increasingly difficult. For a 6-year-old, a week and a half was an eternity. Beth had been gone so long that Morgan was seriously beginning to doubt her return. For the most part, Gus had managed to keep his own doubts to himself. The advice he'd gotten was to remain positive in front of Morgan. That didn't mean walking around the house with an ear-to-ear smile, nor did it mean lying to her. She could see the worry in his face, so there was little point in telling her he wasn't concerned. Last night, however, he might have been a little too honest. It was on their third late-night go-round after the story-reading session at 11 o'clock and another glass of water at 1 a.m. Morgan was still wide awake. Clearly something was weighing on her mind. Gus carried her from the bed and held her on his lap as they rocked in the glider. Her head lay on his shoulder. He could feel the warm breath against his neck, the baby-fine hair brushing against his skin. They rocked in the glow of her Little Mermaid nightlight. It took a few minutes, but finally she opened up. She spoke without looking at him, her cheek against his chest.
"Daddy?"
"Yes?"
"What's a reward?"
He knew where this was headed, so he answered carefully. "It's like a prize that you give to a person who does a good deed."
"A kid at school said there was a reward for Mommy."
"That's true. If anyone can bring Mommy back to us, that would be a good deed. So I'll give them a reward."
"What are you going to give them?"
"Money."
"How much?"
"A lot."
"All the money we have?"
"No, not all of it."
"Why not?"
"Because we don't have to give that much."
"How do you know that?"
"I just know."
"But Mommy isn't back. What if a reward isn't big enough?"
"It's big enough. But if they ask for more, we'll give it to them." They rocked in silence. Then she asked,
"How much more?"
"Whatever it takes."
"Would you give them your car?"
"Absolutely."
"How about the house?"
"If we had to, I would."
"Would you give them Aunt Carla?"
That elicited a half smile. "No, honey, we can't do that."
"Would you give them me?"
"Never," he said firmly. "Not in a million years." She nuzzled the nape of his neck and asked softly,
"What about you?"
"What about me?"
"If they wanted you as their reward, would you go?"
He didn't answer right away. Not because he didn't know the answer, but because he had never thought of it in those terms. "Yes, I would." He felt her cling tighter, her voice filled with urgency.
"You would go too?"
"No, I would go instead of Mommy. Mommy would come back." Her body shivered.
"But what if it was a trick? What if both of you went away?"
"That's not going to happen. Don't worry about that. I promise you that will never happen." She nearly crawled inside him. She pressed as much of her body against his as was physically possible. This close, he could practically see her thoughts. He could definitely feel her fears, and it made him regret having said he might go away under any circumstances. All he could do was hang on tight and reassure her. They remained that way for almost 2 hours, till Morgan finally fell asleep. After putting her down, Gus didn't even try falling back to sleep. He needed something to occupy his mind. Pre-dawn television didn't cut it. The newspaper had yet to be delivered. His eyes drifted toward the framed photographs on the dresser. There were at least a dozen of them. The frames were old, some of them from the days when he and Beth were just living together. Over time, however, the pictures had changed. It was an interesting progression, he thought. It used to be him and Beth, the two of them snow skiing, the two of them at Haystack Rock. Then came the engagement and wedding pictures. The baby pictures followed, Morgan in her bassinet, Morgan and Mommy. He scanned the entire dresser. There wasn't a single picture of him and Morgan. Curious, he went to the closet and dragged down the old shoeboxes that held all their photographs. Over the next several hours, he went through them slowly, box by box, oldest to newest. The old ones were familiar and brought back memories. The new ones, however, were truly new to him. He hadn't been the photographer for any of them. He wasn't in any of them. He hadn't even seen most of them before. He returned to the older ones, back to a time when he was still part of the family. His favorite one he had taken of Morgan in her crib when she was just 8 months old, before things really started to tank between him and Beth. A ray of sunlight streamed through the slats on the Bermuda shutters. It angled perfectly toward her crib, shooting like a laser beam. Morgan stared at it intently, reaching for it, trying to grasp it in her tiny fingers. Gus snapped a perfect shot that captured the moment exactly. Friends and family who saw it had the same reaction, just like her dad, mad because she can't have everything. Looking at it now, Gus saw it differently. There was no anger or frustration in baby Morgan's eyes. It was simple fascination. The look of determination was so strong that if you stared at the photo long enough, you couldn't help but put aside your own grown-up notion of the laws of physics. You'd swear she could reach out and grab it, even bend it and twist it as she wished. She had the innate gift of making the impossible seem possible. But that didn't make her a hopeless overachiever like her dad. As the years had made clear, she also had the wisdom to leave certain things be and enjoy them for what they were. That made her more like her mother, the Beth he remembered.
Daddy?
He looked up, startled. Morgan was standing in the doorway, still in her pajamas.
Are you going to take me to school?
He checked the clock and groaned. It was already after 9. Oh, boy, we're late. He quickly started stuffing photographs back into the boxes. In his haste, he spilled a bulging stack all over the rug. Morgan came to help gather them up. She handed him one after the other. It was slower that way, but Gus liked the teamwork.
Thank you, he said as she handed him the last one. Should I get ready for school?
He was about to say yes, then reconsidered. She probably hadn't noticed that her father wasn't in a single one of the dozen photographs she just handed over, but he certainly had. He had planned to take another run at Shirley Borge, but she probably could use another day to cool off anyway. Morgan, why don't you and I take the day off?
And do what?
Anything you want. Go ice skating, go to the zoo, anything at all. Her eyes brightened.
You mean we're going to play hooky together?
Yeah, he said with a thin smile. I think it's about time. It took just minutes to fill his duffel bag with the basic necessities, though everything was folded and arranged with precision. One change of pants, 2 clean shirts, extra thermal socks and underwear, 3 long-sleeve cotton turtlenecks and a heavy wool sweater, a toothbrush and toothpaste, a straight-edge razor with just a bar of soap, no shaving cream, a Swiss Army knife, flammable steel wool, and some waterproof matches. His weekend in the mountains would require a little more. The retreat was just one day away. Already he could feel the increased flow of energy, feel the change in his level of vibration. Energy was power. Power was his sustenance, his power over others. The window shade was drawn and the room was dark, though not completely black. A 4-watt bulb in the bathroom cast a faint glow that reached all the way to the bed. He could see only because his pupils had adjusted, and he could see quite well. The pattern on the bedspread, the curves beneath the covers, her head resting on the pillow. He took a silent step forward, then another, till he was at the edge of the bed and standing directly over her. She was sound asleep. No surprise. After what she'd been through this past week, she couldn't possibly know night from day. That was power. He laid his packed duffel bag on the chair, then rested a black leather bag atop the dresser and zipped it open. Inside was a pair of rubber gloves, a 3-foot stick, a length of rope, a longer stretch of the same yellow nylon rope, and a knife. This, too, was power, but it was the easy way. This time there could be no props or tools, no worldly instruments of any kind. He would have to summon deeper powers. He was certain he could do it. He had that gift, he knew. All he had to do was will it, and it would be so. He drew a deep, cleansing breath, closed his eyes, and focused. Slowly he exhaled. His lungs emptied, but he continued to exhale. His body called for air, but the mind said no. The lungs began to burn, but he refused to draw a breath. He struggled with the pain until it became a numbness. Dizziness set in. He felt rocky on his feet. Just at the point it seemed unbearable, the blackness became a vision. He could suddenly see the tightness in the rope, the pressure around the neck. He could feel the woman's body twitching, hear the pounding of her heart. He drew on all his powers of concentration, his powers of vibration, every ounce of mental strength and energy. Beads of sweat gathered on his brow. His face showed signs of strain. His grip tightened on the dresser's edge. He grimaced one last time and fell to his knees, barely conscious. He groaned, gasping for air. He gobbled it up quick, erratic breaths. After a few moments, he regained control. He took another deep, cleansing breath and smiled to himself, his eyes still closed. It was the thin smile of the victor. His success was palpable, as real as ever before. The deed was as good as done. Such was his power over others. The power of the Source. Chapter 48. Andy was reasonably patient, but by mid-Thursday afternoon she could wait no longer. More than 24 hours had passed since Isaac's announcement that he wanted to think about the undercover assignment. She wasn't about to let him think it to death. The FBI was like every place else in that respect. Too many decisions were made by not making a decision. "Got a minute?" she said, standing in the open doorway. He didn't look surprised to see her, but he didn't look thrilled either. He waved her in and signaled to close the door. She did, then sat in the armchair facing his desk. He leaned back in his leather chair and said, "You want my decision, I take it." "Not to be pushy, but Bleckman's retreat is tomorrow." "I can think of plenty of reasons to let you go. You're the logical choice, since you've already got your foot in the door. For my money, you're the most talented young agent in the office. And to be perfectly frank, I don't have a slew of agents willing to put their lives on hold and infiltrate a cult. Which makes me wonder, why do you want to do this?"
"Because I honestly believe it will lead us to Beth Wheatley."
He leaned forward, elbows on the desk. "No, I mean, why do you really want to do this?"
"You mean, do I think it will be a professional challenge? Good for my career? Better than another weekend of rented movies and microwave popcorn?"
"I'm being serious. This is a dangerous assignment. I don't want someone going into it for the wrong reason."
"What would be the wrong reason?"
"Oh, I don't know. But hypothetically, let's say someone was still feeling a little hurt or embarrassed about a wedding that literally turned into a brawl at the altar. Maybe she'd jump at an undercover assignment as a convenient escape."
She was momentarily speechless.
That has nothing to do with this.
Don't be mad. I just want to be sure you're going into this with a clear head. That's my professional responsibility.
I know it wasn't that long ago, but emotionally, Rick is so far behind me, it isn't funny.
Are you sure?
Are you sure your interest is purely professional?
She wasn't being accusatory, just giving him another opening. Isaac softened his expression, but remained all business. This weekend retreat is probably the kind of place where new recruits are expected to talk about themselves. If I approve the assignment, you understand you'll need a lot more than phony IDs. You'll have to create a whole family history.
That's easy. I'm adopted, remember?
No one has given more thought to another life than an adopted child. Don't think I'm crazy, but I have plenty of imaginary parents to choose from. Cults tend to prey on the emotionally wounded. You'd have to invent something on the dysfunctional side.
No problem. Going to Yakima has already triggered some thoughts along those lines.
How do you mean? She was thinking of the drunken prostitute at the hotel, but she saw no point in sharing her fears about the mother she'd never known.
It's nothing, really. Just believe me, I can construct a phony family so dysfunctional they'll name me Cult Recruit of the Month.
You wouldn't want to overdo it. One of the biggest problems for an undercover agent is remembering the story she tells. It's a good idea to stick to the truth as much as possible, at least on things that don't matter. Like, do you have any brothers or sisters? Did you take dance lessons as a girl? What does your father do for a living?
Am I a half-breed who was adopted and raised by middle-class white parents?
Now that you mention it, that is a rather plausible background for someone who might have issues later in life. Someone who might eventually be drawn to a cult. He saw the expression on her face, then backpedaled. I didn't mean you...
It's okay.
I don't want you to think you have to embrace any particular backstory just to earn my approval. If I were doing this assignment, I'd obviously have to go as a black man. But you look white. You were raised white. You can be white. Or you can be Indian. Or you can be mixed. You have that unique luxury.
It's no luxury, said Andy.
Bad choice of word, sorry.
Very bad.
She could have told him how in college she'd gone to a powwow on the UW campus and was shunned as just another horny white chick on the prowl for a brown Indian warrior. How the scholarship committee had rejected her claim of Native American status because she had no idea what tribe her mother belonged to. How as a girl she'd kept an ayatomat, a hemp string diary that marked the most important days of her life with knots and colored beads, only to have her mother take it away and burn it out of fear that it was linked to some kind of devil worship.
Isaac, are you giving me this assignment or not?
Yes, I am.
Thank you.
She was startled but pleased. You're welcome, but you should probably thank Victoria more than me.
Victoria?
I had a talk with her about an hour ago, just to see what she thought about you taking the assignment. She's been down on the dumps lately, which accounts for her lackluster performance on this case. I think she sees some of her old self in you. You play your cards right, you might just find yourself a mentor.
She'd want to mentor me?
She's already looking out for you. Doesn't want to see you passed over as a young and inexperienced female for risky assignments like this one, never getting the chance to build the kind of record you need to make it all the way to the top. Andy knew about Victoria's failed bid for chief of the Child Abduction and Serial Killer Unit. Knew that no woman had ever been chief of a profiling unit at Quantico.
Funny, my toughest critics have always been women. It's nice to have one on my side. Thanks for passing that along.
You're welcome. And again, I apologize for my stupid comments about cults and your mixed heritage. I was out of line.
Forget it. It's just complicated when you're adopted. You wonder about different things, like brothers or sisters who might have been raised elsewhere. Maybe their lives were more difficult than mine, but maybe they also understand who they are better than I do. Does that make any sense?
Sure. They sat in silence, as if there had been enough said about that. Andy checked her watch. If it's a go, then I better pay the tech guys a visit.
Definitely.
She rose and started for the door. Oh, Andy, he called. She stopped and turned. Isaac shook his head, half smiling and half scowling. Damn it, Kira, you flunked your first test.
That will never happen again, sir.
She smiled and gave a mock salute as she left the office.
At least I hope not, she told herself, her smile fading to concern.
It was a foggy Friday morning on Puget Sound. The sun wouldn't rise for more than an hour, so the thick gray shroud hovering over the Washington Correction Center for Women hadn't even begun to burn off. In the pre-dawn silence, the bare cement floors and cinder block walls were at their coldest. Most inmates were asleep in their cells. Several dozen, however, spent the night in the large common sleeping area, a temporary arrangement to alleviate overcrowding in the minimum security unit. Row after row of metal beds stood draped in white sheets and blue blankets. The unlucky women near the security lights lay with pillows over their eyes to block out the perpetual glow. Those bunked beside the snorers had their ears stuffed with wadded toilet paper. At 5 a.m., a corrections officer passed through for a head count. He walked at such a slow and steady pace that the rhythmic clicking of his heels was like the ticking of a giant clock. He passed each row, disturbing no one. Most slept right through the inspection. The few who were awakened quickly rolled over and went back to sleep. His pace slowed even more as he reached the back row. It was darker there, farther from the security lights and harder to see. The headcount continued without pause till he reached the ninth bunk. It looked lumpy but strange. He switched on his flashlight. The bed was empty. By itself, that wasn't cause for panic. It wouldn't have been the first time an inmate had stolen away to the bathroom or crawled in bed with her lover. But then he noticed something else. He pulled back the blanket. The bedsheet was gone. That did alarm him. He grabbed his walkie-talkie and alerted the command center in a voice filled with urgency. Security breach in Unit 1. Lights on. The pulsating alarm sounded as the emergency lights switched on to full intensity. Dozens of drowsy inmates grumbled and rolled out of bed. A team of correctional officers raced down a secured corridor to the sleeping area. As the electronic doors slid open, they broke into pairs and dispersed throughout the unit in systematic fashion. Line up, they shouted. The inmates stood at some semblance of attention as the guards checked off each one and searched under the bunks. They found only one per bunk. No one was caught sharing. That meant one inmate was still missing. Three guards rushed into the bathroom. Their footsteps echoed off the bright white walls.
Anyone in here? Shouted the senior guard.
A quick visual inspection revealed no one at the long row of sinks or toilets. They entered the large community shower room and froze. The missing bedsheet was taut and twisted like a rope tied to a water pipe overhead. A woman was hanging by the neck, her toes dangling just 6 inches above the shower drain. She was completely naked, her clothes balled up and stashed in the corner.
Get her down.
The biggest guard supported the limp body as the others unfastened the makeshift noose around her neck. They laid her on the floor and checked the pulse. There was none. In desperation, one of the guards started CPR, but the others stopped him. The body was too cold. She was clearly beyond resuscitation. The senior guard stepped away and shook his head, angry and distraught.
Damn it, Shirley. What in the hell made you go and do that?
This ends Disc 8, Under Cover of Darkness, Disc 9.
Part 5, Chapter 49.
The bus left Yakima at 10 a.m. It was an old yellow school bus that had been painted a dull blue. The windshield had a long, elaborate crack in it that resembled the Big Dipper. The rubber flooring had worn away to bare metal in the most heavily trafficked spots. Years of juvenile graffiti covered the seatbacks. Joey and Donna, Donna stuffs. Joey is a homo. Andy recognized two men and three women from Tuesday night's gathering. She counted six other women and five men, including the driver. Based on the familiarity they demonstrated toward one another, she presumed these 11 were already members. Felicia and Tom, the two who had spoken to the group on Wednesday, were in charge. They had made sure everybody was accounted for, that their baggage was stored properly, and that each recruit had taken the appropriate seat on the bus. Seats were assigned. There did seem to be a plan and structure. As they headed out of town, Felicia stood at the front of the bus and addressed the group over the rumble of the noisy old motor. "Now that we're finally underway, I want to officially welcome each one of you and thank you for coming. Retreats are a time for newcomers to find out what we're all about and for existing members to revitalize their energy. For some of you, this could be the most important weekend of your life. Don't be frustrated if you don't immediately feel changes in your flow of energy or your level of vibration. Look at this weekend as a first step, not the complete journey. The bus ride should take about 3 hours. We've tried to mix the bus evenly with experienced members and newcomers, so please take the time to meet your neighbors. Talk if you like, or just look out the window and relax. Any questions?" The group was silent. Finally, an old man raised his hand, the guy Bleckman had teased at Tuesday's meeting. His wife wasn't with him.
"Exactly where are we going?"
That was something Andy, too, had been wondering. The precise destination had never been disclosed. "The source." Felicia paused as if to emphasize that nothing more needed to be said, then smiled smugly and returned to her seat. For the first 90 minutes of the bus ride, Andy made small talk with the man behind her and two women across the aisle. None of them struck her as particularly loony. The women were young, practically girls. They had worked a variety of odd jobs, not sure of what to do with their lives. The man was a musician who played nightclubs in second-rate hotels. Andy talked only of her recent experience at the Second Chance clothing store, which was as far back in Kira's employment history as she needed to go. It wasn't long before Andy realized that undercover work was a lot like dating. To be successful, all you had to do was act interested and get the other guy talking about his favorite subject, himself. Throughout the ride, Felicia had been making her way from the front to the back, stopping to visit individually with each newcomer for 10 or 15 minutes. Andy was about two-thirds of the way back. Felicia reached her at the two-hour mark, right on schedule. "Can I join you for a minute, Kira?"
"Sure."
Felicia took the seat on the aisle, but said nothing. Andy surmised it was her job to ask the questions.
"So, how often do you have these retreats?"
"About once a month. Sometimes twice a month in the summer."
More often than Andy would have guessed. The fact that they were having a retreat the same week she had gone to work at the used clothing store wasn't quite the lucky coincidence she had thought it was.
"Is this a good turnout?"
"Pretty decent, yeah."
A million questions swirled in Andy's head, but she didn't want to come across as overly inquisitive, too much like a cop. After a minute of silence, Felicia asked,
"Anything special you'd like to know, Kira?"
"Where the hell is Beth Wheatley?" she thought.
"Nothing specific comes to mind. I'm just taking your advice, you know, taking things one step at a time."
"That's really the only way, one step at a time."
"Just out of curiosity, how many steps are there?"
Felicia smiled as though the question were naive.
"That depends on the individual." "I hope you don't mind my asking, but how many steps have you taken?"
"One of your goals is to figure that out for yourself. By the end of this weekend, you should be able to interpret the energy given off by others and determine their level of vibration."
Does that mean you know my level of vibration? Yours is the most basic level, Kira. Very human. But don't be discouraged. We all started at the beginning. Even Steve Bleckman. He'll be here this weekend, right? When I asked at the orientation meeting, you said Steve was coming. He's coming. Why isn't he here on the bus? He just has to be very careful on retreats. What do you mean? He has to limit the time he spends with us. We'll all get to meet him, right? Felicia hedged. I'm afraid you won't. None of the newcomers will. Why not? He'll be spending his time with the more experienced members. He can't even take the time to say hello to us? It's not that simple. Before you go one-on-one with Steve, you have to be prepared. Without the proper preparation, newcomers tend to feed too strongly off his energy. They become leeches. That sort of overindulgence is not what this is all about. You must know exactly how much to take, and you must take no more. How do I begin my preparation? Felicia seemed pleased that she had asked, as if her eagerness were a good thing. You will begin tonight. I can't wait, she replied, and she truly meant it. News of Shirley's death had left Gus numb. Friday was the day he had planned another visit to follow up on her lawyer's insights about the conspiracy to commit murder. Whether she was in a gang or not wasn't all that crucial. He simply wanted the names of her co-conspirators. He wanted to find out if they, like Shirley, had known Beth. Perhaps they even knew what had happened to her. Shirley and her unnamed co-conspirators had seemed like his best lead, until this morning. Throughout the morning, Gus repeatedly phoned Andy and left messages, but she didn't return any of them. He did finally get a call back from Agent Haveries, who said he had taken over Agent Henning's responsibilities on the Wheatley case. That didn't sit well with Gus. Something was amiss, and he wasn't getting any answers by telephone. At lunchtime, he headed to the FBI building downtown and demanded to speak to Andy's supervisor. Lundquist kept him waiting in the lobby for almost an hour. Finally, when it was clear Gus wasn't going to give up and go home, a receptionist brought him back to the supervisor's corner office. The introductions were brief, the small talk non-existent. Gus got directly to the point. Where is Agent Henning, and why won't she return my calls? The bluntness startled Lundquist. She's been reassigned. To where? Siberia? To a case and location that is confidential, just as Agent Haveries told you this morning. He didn't tell me squat. All he said was that he's taken over Andy's cases. That's really all you need to know, isn't it? What I need to know is why the sudden change in the way the FBI treats me. At the beginning, I felt totally informed. Ever since my wife called from that payphone in Oregon, it's as if somebody has cut the phone lines. There's a balance we have to strike, Mr. Wheatley. On the one hand, the FBI wants to keep the victim's family up to date. On the other, we can't jeopardize the investigation with leaks. I'm part of the investigation. If I'm in the dark, we can't help each other. That's why I encourage you to pass along any information you have, no matter how trivial you think it might be. And all I expect in return is for the FBI to answer a few questions for me. I'll do my best. Does Agent Henning's sudden disappearance have anything to do with the fact that Shirley Borge was found dead this morning?
I can't answer that.
That's what this is all about, isn't it?